You're listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
Hello to you all. Welcome to Viewpoints on today's show. The Brooklyn Marina rolls out the red carpet for Nova Scotia sailing ambassador to famous Blue Nose 2.
People are sweet. It's beautiful. It's super awesome. We really like going around this area and figured we'd go do a little vacay, like staycation basically around the South Coast. So it's great.
We stay on the water as the Great Lakes coastal cleanup hits the city of Kingston, Ontario.
You know, everyone in our community understands the importance of sustainability and environmental stewardship, doing what we can as a community. This is one of those tangible things that I think, you know, you can really see the impact of right away.
To Montreal, where a gardening group is trying to revive a long-lost and historic melon.
The melon was being sold to very wealthy areas in New York City, Boston, Philadelphia. Very, very wealthy people would go to the Delmonico and order the elusive Montreal melon.
Domestic beer sales are down in Newfoundland and Labrador, but cannabis sales are on the rise.
For younger people, we are seeing some changes.
A 60-foot electric bus is on the road in Winnipeg and paves the way for possible expansion.
We are looking at scaling up our articulated bus fleet substantially in the next couple of years.
Andy Canine stars an American stunt dog show, makes a stop in BC's Bulkley Valley.
I love it. Look at it. It's beautiful. Like, it's gorgeous. The people are amazing. The weather is perfect.
Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
You are on the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Hello, welcome again. Nice to have you with us. My name is Boris Hassan. I'll be with you for the next half hour. And our journalist will take us today to Newfoundland, Ontario, BC, Manitoba, and Nova Scotia. And that is where we first set sail as the Brooklyn Marina rolled down the red carpet for Nova Scotia's sailing ambassador to Blue Nose 2. A few dozen people turned down to meet the crew of the schooner touring southwestern Nova Scotia. Others drove down the small wharf in Brooklyn or towards the breakwater to get a look across the Liverpool Bay, where the sailboat was anchored near Port Mercy Commercial Park. The tour of southwestern Nova Scotia was hatched after the Blue Nose crew canceled an early September trip to Gloucester, Massachusetts. Instead, they said they'd do what so many other Canadians are doing this year, stay closer to home and support local tourism. Rick Conrad in Liverpool, Nova Scotia, had a chance to admire the ship.
Welcome to the Brooklyn Marina.
Thank you.
Big 13 sails, and you can only put up one for me.
The Brooklyn Marina rolled out the welcome mat for Nova Scotia's sailing ambassador on Tuesday evening. A few dozen people turned out to meet the crew of Blue Nose 2 at the small clubhouse as it visited the Liverpool area in its first stop on a tour of southwestern Nova Scotia. Others drove down the small wharf in Brooklyn or towards the breakwater to get a look across Liverpool Bay to where the schooner was anchored. Captain Phil Watson was one of the dozen or so crew members who shuttled from the sailing icon to the marina.
We haven't been here in a long time, and we were developing a cruise along the Southwest Nova, and so Liverpool it is. There's great alumni support here and community support, and the club has always been good to us, so it's pretty easy to put Liverpool on the list.
The tour of southwestern Nova Scotia was hatched after the Blue Nose crew canceled an early September trip to Gloucester, Massachusetts. Instead, they said they'd do what so many other Canadians are doing this year, stay closer to home and support local tourism. The last time the Blue Nose 2 was in Liverpool was in 2021, as the ship celebrated 100 years of Blue Nose history. Kate Smith, a deckhand from Sydney, Nova Scotia, is spending her third summer on the Blue Nose. It was her first visit to Liverpool.
I love it. It's great. People are sweet. It's beautiful. It's super awesome. We really like going around this area and figured we'd go do a little vacay, like staycation basically around the South Coast. So it's great.
Liverpool's Craig Harding sailed on the schooner as a 20-year-old from 1968 to 1969.
I'd been on fishing boats, on draggers and so on, but I'd never been on a sailboat until that year, and I learned to sail on her. I've been connected to the Blue Noses ever since. Hard not to be. Yeah, really, really happy to see the support. It was beautiful to see her come in.
Jamie Frankel of Massachusetts just happened to be at the marina on Tuesday when he heard about the Blue Nose's visit. He and some others arrived on the Sequester a couple of days before to wait for better weather to continue their journey through the Gulf of Maine.
None of us knew she was going to be coming at the time, so this is an incredibly welcome surprise. As the sailing ambassador for Nova Scotia, I think everyone loves her, but in addition, she has beautiful lines as a ship, and as a tall ship of that size, I'd say that it's always a wonderful event to be someplace where she comes in, and it's the splendor of old sailing ships and old style sailing ships.
Captain Watson says the Blue Nose always draws a crowd.
It's, you know, bringing a fishing schooner back to a fishing community often. You know, all these communities have shipbuilding, fishing heritage, and these schooners, whether it was a fishing schooner or a cargo schooner, they all have that history is there. So to be able to put a thing in place in the harbor where you can then talk about it, and you can talk about, oh, well, those schooners used to be here all the time, or they used to build them over there. It's a chance for the community to talk about the history of their communities and share it within themselves, and hopefully they'll come and share it with us as well.
The Blue Nose 2 is planning to leave Liverpool on Wednesday afternoon. Its next stops are in Clark's Harbor, Yarmouth, Digby, and Lower West Pubnico. I'm Rick Conrad.
Okay, come on in.
We'll try and keep the foolishness to a minimum.
Hi, this is Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick. You're attuned to Viewpoints.
The City of Kingston, Ontario will participate in the first ever Great Lakes Coastal Cleanup on World Rivers Day, September 28. Kingston will be one of six Ontario communities taking part in the first ever Great Lakes Coastal Cleanup. The event is hosted by the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence Cities Initiative. These six communities participating in this first multi-site cleanup are Thunder Bay, Chatham-Kent, Owen Sound, Collingwood, Cobourg, and Kingston. According to the Rochester Institute of Technology, more than 22 million pounds of plastic pollution end up in the Great Lakes every year. The lakes provide drinking water for over 40 million Canadians and Americans. Christina Laurie has that story.
This September, Kingston will be one of six Ontario communities taking part in the province's first ever Great Lakes Coastal Cleanup. The event is organized by the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence Cities Initiative, a coalition representing communities in the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence River region. The organization secured $85,000 in provincial funding to support the shoreline cleanups taking place in Thunder Bay, Chatham-Kent, Owen Sound, Collingwood, Cobourg, and Kingston. On World Rivers Day, September 28th, volunteers across Ontario will gather with the goal of collecting up to 440 pounds of litter along beaches, parks, and waterfronts. Mayor Brian Patterson spoke with CFRC regarding Kingston's part in the project.
I think it's actually a really exciting initiative. You know, when I think about all the characteristics and all the things that make Kingston, Kingston, you know, there's lots of things that I can think of, but one of, I think, the most important treasures that we have is our waterfront. And it's something that, you know, people just are naturally drawn to our waterfront. There's so many amazing places to enjoy. We've invested a lot as a city in different places and public spaces where people can go and appreciate and enjoy the waterfront. And so I think that really this event is about, you know, capturing our community's imagination in terms of making sure with stewardship that we're taking care of that waterfront, we're preserving it, and making sure that it continues to be just an amazing part of our city.
Local organizations and businesses have been stepping up to ensure the day will be a success.
What's been exciting is the number of local partner organizations that are really kind of going to be on the ground doing the work, whether it's Sustainable Kingston, you have Ahoy Rentals that's making, basically offering free kayaks for people that want to go along the shoreline and help clean up. We've also got our amazing diving community. They're going to be doing some of the in-water cleanup. We've got Rotary. We've got a number of different organizations that are that have agreed and are happy to sign up. And so that is really inspiring, right? I mean, we have a Swim Drink Fish, which is another great organization that's really big into stewardship of clean water. And so, you know, I think it really has hit a nerve with a lot of people and a lot of organizations. And so I think we're going to have a small army out there on September the 28th. It'll be exciting to see.
While the project is starting with one-time provincial funding, Patterson says the momentum could encourage more initiatives like this in the future.
I think anything is possible. I think given the momentum that we've seen, I think there's absolutely opportunities to continue to do events like this. And in the past, there have even been a number of local groups that have gone out and of their own initiative have done what they can to clean up the our shoreline and to do what they can to beautify our waterfront. I think given that goal, I think there's always going to be community level interest, whether it will be under this umbrella or maybe just something else. I mean, we'll see how things evolve. You know, this is a really great opportunity. And obviously, we've been granted some one-time funding from the province. So we want to take advantage and do as best we can. If there's interest in continued partnership in future years, of course, we're more than happy to explore that. You know, everyone in our community understands the importance of sustainability and environmental stewardship, doing what we can as a community. But this is one of those tangible things that I think, you know, you can really see the impact of right away.
Thanks to Christina Laurie in Kingston, Ontario. Gardening group in Montreal's Notre-Dame-de-Grâce Borough, or NDG, is trying to revive an historic melon. It's called the Montreal melon. It was once a luxury good grown right in NDG and shipped to places like New York and Philadelphia. Farmers used to grow it as early as 1905, just where the Decarie Boulevard is now built. The regrowing of the melon is a project in living agricultural history. Adam Innes got his hands dirty to bring back this story to us.
Real champagne comes from Champagne, France, Parmesan cheese from Emilia-Romagna in Italy, and the Montreal melon comes from the borough of Notre-Dame-de-Grâce in Montreal. The Montreal melon was once a luxury good grown right in NDG and shipped to places like New York and Philadelphia. It was a popular and famous fruit from the 1880s into the mid-1930s, until it went practically extinct. Now, in 2025, a gardening group based out of the Loyola campus is trying to revive and recultivate the Montreal melon and restore it, at least locally, to its former glory. But growing this melon has been a story of trials and tribulations, beetles, bad luck, and theft.
The Montreal melon has been like great mythos among Montreal gardeners.
That was Nico Quinn, the co-founder of Cult of Action, a community gardening and food security group that has been protecting and gardening a plot of land at Loyola campus since 2022. Quinn is the manager of the Loyola plot. Hear them explain a bit of the history of the Montreal melon.
The melon was being sold to very wealthy areas in New York City, Boston, Philadelphia. Most notably, it was served at the Delmonico Hotel, which today is still known for its like kitchen fare. It's a very, very expensive hotel. And it would be sold cartside, so like very, very wealthy people would go to the Delmonico and order the elusive Montreal melon, and it would be brought up by a worker who would slice one melon. It would be $2 or $3, which today would be anywhere from $70 to $100.
The Montreal melon, also known as the nutmeg melon for its distinct nutmeg flavor, was difficult to grow and ship. By the mid-1900s, it began falling out of fashion, and by the 1960s, it was thought to be extinct.
It's a very expensive melon. It's labor intensive to grow and to ship. So it did not serve the international factory food system needs of, you know, being ready to be shipped. It like doesn't continue to ripen once it's refrigerated. So this is why it starts to demand. And now we have the rise of, you know, its descendant, like later on coming the honeydew, the cantaloupe. They're a derivative of this Montreal melon.
But seeds have been discovered in different places since the 1990s for the Montreal melon. Last year, an anonymous source left 200 of the seeds on a desk in Dawson College, belonging to a friend of the garden. The Cult of Action Garden gave away many of these seeds to other local community groups and sold several to hobby gardeners around NDG. But here at the Loyola plot, they focused resources and energy on regrowing the Montreal melon. This notoriously finicky, nearly extinct fruit still proved difficult to grow. Beetles ate many of the melons. Others were destroyed by groundhogs. One prized melon remained growing at the cultivation garden, but just as it had almost ripened the morning of this report, the perfect Montreal melon was stolen.
So yeah, it is, and you know, any volunteer who has come, anyone who will listen, I have told, you know, the history and how special it is, and now that they are a part of history. Like, anyone who weeds that melon, looks at that melon, I'd be sure to let them know, like, you know, you're one of 100 people who have seen this melon in the modern age. Like, it's very special for us all to be invested in it. And now it has been taken. So we're all devastated. Like, it's been a tough morning because we discovered it today. So it's been like 2 hours of screaming and crying and pounding our fists into the ground because it's been taken. Like, what the heck? And I guess in a way, I hope that they knew what it was, because if they didn't know and they picked an unripe Montreal melon and then not e- like be like, this doesn't even taste good. Like, but they didn't just take a melon. Like, it is a piece of agricultural history, and that a lot of our community members are emotionally bound up in. So it's a huge loss.
Despite this theft, the attempts to regrow the Montreal melon continue around the borough, with this plot at the Loyola campus leading the initiative.
So, for example, some Italians will say it's not limoncello if the lemons aren't from the Amalfi Coast or Sorrento or areas like this. Those are regions. Here in the Montreal melon, this is the NDG melon. Because of the microclimate that happens, you know, of course we're on an island, the microclimate that happens in between Mount Royal and the St. Lawrence, and we're on a sloped hill, we're in the valley of this area. So it's a very, very specific microclimate. So a Montreal melon that's grown in Rosemont is not going to be the same as a Montreal melon that's grown in NDG. It is the most hyperlocal food, vegetable, anything. Like, even matsutake mushroom is very famous for, you know, Japan. It's also in BC. But like, the Montreal melon, even the difference in borough, will change the flavor of the melon.
For the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Adam Minnis.
On the air with Viewpoints.
We now stay on dry land and move to Winnipeg, Manitoba now, where riders will soon have the chance to take a trip on Winnipeg's transit largest zero-emission bus, or ZEBS. Winnipeg's first 60-foot ZEB will also be the first in Canada to take the road. Aaron Cook, project manager for the Transition to Zero-Emission Bus Program, says the next month will not only allow residents to experience these new buses, but also provide valuable information before full operations begin. Winnipeg's Transit announced in March that it will add 16 zero-emission buses to its fleet as part of the Transition to Zero Emission Bus Program. Taking the ride, here's Ryan Funk.
Riders will now have the chance to take a trip on Winnipeg Transit's largest zero-emission buses. For 30 days, the first 60-foot ZEBs will be in limited service, making the city the first in Canada to put 60-foot electric buses on the road. Aaron Cook, project manager for the Transition to Zero Emission Bus Program, says the next month will not only allow residents to experience these new buses, but also provide valuable information before full operations begin.
The first bus has been going out on the FX3 line. Limited service right now has been putting the buses out in the morning, so they go out between 4:35 a.m. And then we'll be out for about 4 hours. That's just to make sure that they're operational during the time here, that we have our mechanics on staff and ready to deal with any issues that happen.
In March, Winnipeg Transit announced the addition of 16 zero-emission buses to its fleet as part of the Transition to Zero-Emission Bus Program. Cook says that with ZEB's plan to enter the network this fall, they want to ensure which configuration is most efficient.
With our new network, we are looking at scaling up our articulated bus fleet substantially in the next couple of years. So that's why we wanted to get these articulated buses on the street now, so that we can really test the challenges with them. And seeing the other advantage of a fuel cell bus is fueling time too. So we can fuel a bus in 10 to 15 minutes, whereas an articulated battery battery electric bus has to charge for 6 to 7 hours.
Transit has ordered a second batch of ZEBs, comprising 24 units, which are scheduled to start production later this week in Winnipeg. The total purchased is now 65.
Yeah, we really took a different approach than a lot of other cities in Canada. So rather than picking the easiest routes to electrify, we took the approach of wanting to buy everything and test everything, because we didn't want to continually have to pilot buses like we so many transit agencies have done in the past. We wanted to see this as a one-time trial, and then we are able to rapidly scale up because we know exactly what we're getting with each type of bus.
Cook says the plan is to expand the ZEB fleet to 90 buses, which she estimates will be about 15% of the rest of Winnipeg's bus fleet. Provisions are also being built into the new North Garage, set to open in 2028 to accommodate even greater growth.
Yeah, it's huge. It's a really exciting time here. There's been a lot of people working really hard in the background to make this happen. So it's good to finally see the buses out on the street after months of work here in the background, getting everybody ready for these buses. And I'm excited for the citizens of Winnipeg to get to ride them now.
By the end of the year, the current roster of ZEBs is expected to have all 16 buses in service and regular rotation. I'm Ryan Funk.
Dogs jumping 30 feet into a ball pit, dancing, jumping on their trainer's back, and perching for photos. That's what you'll get watching the traveling stunted dog show Canine Stars that made a stop in BC's Bulkley Valley. Carrie Carraher, the owner of the traveling stunt dog show, says she and her dogs made time to come to the Bulkley Valley every year because she loves to visit British Columbia's rural north. It's a special place for me, she says. The show leading up to the Bulkley Valley was recently New Jersey, and after Smithers, it will be en route to Mexico. Pamela Hassan in Smithers, BC.
This is a traveling show of dog athleticism and stunts performed by high-energy pups of all breeds who are becoming international stars for their stunts and celebrity likeness. Owner Carrie Carraher has been operating Canine Stars since 2012, and her passion for rescue dogs has created a massive following for her crew of forgotten or castaway dogs in America. Her Canine Stars have entertained audiences of the hundreds of thousands. So why exactly do they come to rural northern BC after they've performed for stadiums of fans at Formula One races and America's Got Talent?
My name is Carrie Carraher. I'm the president of the Canine Stars.
Are all the dogs in the show, is every one of them a rescue?
Almost all of them. All of mine are. I have 14, my husband and I, that run the show. And we definitely focus on rescue dogs. I don't know if you guys have as much of a problem up here, but down in the States, it's pretty horrendous how many dogs are in shelters. And they get euthanized because there's not enough homes for them. Mm-hmm. So we always promote, go save a dog at a shelter before, you know, having to go to a breeder and actually buying a dog. You can train any dog. They all have something that they're going to be good at, and that's what we try to do in our show, is find what they're going to be best at.
How, I guess, do you determine what a dog's going to be? Like, are you just kind of trying them out with a bunch of different activities?
Yeah. So, like, the ones that play Frisbee are the dogs that really like to bite and grab at toys and chase toys. They're going to play Frisbee. They're also probably really good at dock diving because they want to jump in the air and grab a toy. Where a freestyle dance dog, you don't have toys involved, and that's more controlled learning actual specific behaviors and tricks that you do for treats. So the dogs that are super treat motivated, we train them things like dog dancing and maybe agility as well.
Where are you from?
I'm from Colorado.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so are you like on a tour, like Smithers BVX, is this like one part of a stop for a tour, or what's your, what's your life like?
Unfortunately, the last show I just did was in New Jersey. And the next show that I'm going to is in Mexico City. So it was not on my route to go to the BVX, but we're here every single year. We love it. We come back no matter what.
Can I ask why you would make the trip all the way up here?
I love it. Look, it's beautiful. Like, it's gorgeous. The people are amazing. The
weather is perfect. We have hiking and go see waterfalls, and it's worth it.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Good, great. Some of these talks have been on America's Got Talent. Mm-hmm. You said F1, like Formula
yep,
One?
Yep, we've performed at Formula One races. We actually have a whole team of dogs called the Dogs of F1 that, like, for example, Opal that was here, she replaces the Formula One driver, George Russell, and we call her George Jack Russell, and she has the full racing suit and everything.
Oh my God.
So we go around at the races. Bumblebee takes the place of the reigning world champion, Max Verstappen, and we call her Max Verstappen. People love it. And our most famous one is the driver, Oscar Piastri, who he's the current leader in Formula One, our dog, Oscar Piastri. And I think she's gotten like 20,000 follows on her Instagram page already this year. So the Dogs of F1 are super famous.
Okay, that's really good. Yeah. I know, I was just trying to think. It's like Lewis Hamilton. It's like, what would be like Lewis Hamilton?
Lou Wolf Hamilton.
So do you already have it? Or are you just like your brain?
Yeah, we do. And it's actually the same chocolate lab that played Simon Cowell on America's Got Talent. She's the one that plays Lewis Hamilton.
Oh, good. Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
Thanks for coming.
Questions or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca.
And our last story will take us to Newfoundland and Labrador, where the province's Liquor Commission, or NLC, is reporting that domestic beer sales are down by 3.7% in the first quarter of this year compared to last year's numbers. However, cannabis sales have increased by 23.5% over last year's first quarter, totaling $29.9 million. President and CEO Bruce Keaton of the NLC says retail sales have been continually growing since marijuana was legalized in 2018. More with Tanya Organ in Corner Brook, Newfoundland.
During the first quarter of this year, the Newfoundland Labrador Liquor Corporation is reporting a decrease of $1.8 million or 3.7% compared to last year's numbers. Net earnings from April to June rang in at $46.2 million, and the corporation believes the decrease is due to beer commissions being down 12.4% as a result of lower domestic beer sales. President and CEO Bruce Keating says overall it's a good start to the fiscal year.
Overall sales numbers have been strong. Like I say, we're up overall, and we've increased the dividend to government for this quarter by the $2.5 million over what we would have paid them for the first quarter of last year. Beverage alcohol sales overall were up about 1.2%, which was pretty close to what we were expecting.
However, cannabis sales increased 23.5% over last year's first quarter, totaling almost $30 million. Keating says retail sales have been continually growing since marijuana was legalized in 2018.
Not a surprise, because, you know, it's still, we're only still about 5 or 6 years beyond legalization. So the industry itself is still maturing. And I think secondly, for younger people, we are seeing some changes. We're seeing it, for example, on the beverage alcohol side, where we're seeing probably slight declines in beer consumption, for example. And part of that's broader demographics. But part of that, like I say, kind of, you know, cannabis right now in this province is probably somewhere between $100 to $120 million on an annual basis.
Keating says there are four new cannabis retailers this year who were not in operation during the first quarter of last year. That brings the total to 59 licensed cannabis retailers in Newfoundland, Labrador. I'm Tanya Organ.
And that's it for this episode of Viewpoints. Thanks to our journalist, Pamela Hassan, Tanya Organ, Rick Conrad, Ryan Funk, Adam Innes, and Christina Laurie. National editors are Conrad Fox and Victoria Fenner. Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassaigne. Thanks for being with us, and until next week, ciao.
Candace Vetter in Embrim, Ontario, and you're tuned into Viewpoints. Follow us on X at Frequency News. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.